The Poor People's Campaign brings its moral revival to Maine. In 1968, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and other community and religious leaders began organizing on behalf of poor and marginalized communities across the country. 50 years later, a new iteration of the Poor People's Campaign is on a tour of 25 states, mobilizing and registering voters, and making a call for a shift in the moral narrative that blames poor people and immigrants for the nation's problems. I'm Keith Shortall, and today I'll talk with the co-chairs of the Poor People's Campaign about why they're in Maine and how they hope to make the issues of poverty, racism, and social and economic justice major themes in the 2020 election. The Poor People's Campaign, today on Maine Calling. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. 51 years ago, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. created the Poor People's Campaign. Its goal was to help the poor and marginalized Americans achieve economic security, something King believed was a key to true citizenship. In the studio with me today is the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, director of the Kairos Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice at Union Theological Seminary. On the line with us is the Reverend Dr. William Barber. He's president and senior lecturer of Repairers of the Breach. He's also an author, preacher, professor, and chief architect of the Forward Together Moral Movement. They are the two leaders of the new Poor People's Campaign that began 2 years ago. It will culminate with a moral march on Washington in June of 2020. Thank you both for joining us today. Appreciate it. As always, we want to hear from you. How do you think the issues of economic and social inequality and injustice should be addressed? And what do you believe are the obstacles to greater equality? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Reverend Theo Harris, I'll start with you, and we'll get to the call for moral revival and what that means in a moment. But first, I want to ask about the tour. You're visiting 25 states, including Maine, to deliver your call for change. But you're also actively registering voters. You're essentially mobilizing the forces for which you are speaking.
So indeed, Maine is the third stop in a 25-state tour. Our tour is called We Must Do More, mobilizing, organizing, registering, educating people for a movement that votes. And so we are here in Maine and have just left North Carolina and before that El Paso, Texas, moving on to New Hampshire, where we're meeting up with a moral fusion movement, people of all walks of life, all races, all ages, impacted by the social issues of our day, from systemic racism to poverty, ecological devastation to the war economy, and what we call a distorted moral narrative, a narrative of Christian religious nationalism, a narrative that pits people against each other, blames poor people, blames people of color, blames immigrants for all of society's problems, and feeds us a lie of scarcity, that there isn't enough when we can actually solve all of the social problems, all of the injustices that are impacting our communities right now.
And Reverend Barber, I know you have to leave here in a few minutes, so I appreciate you joining us here. How did you choose which 25 states to visit? Were they places with significant poor populations that you wanted to rally? Why Maine, for example?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on, and thank you for having Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris on, who's one of the most brilliant scholars, both in New Testament and economics. You know, you just said something a minute ago in the intro, for instance, that we will culminate on June 20 of 2020. Actually, June 20 of 2020 will be just another stage of this campaign. It's long term. What's happening on June 20 of 2020 is after 2 years of organizing, waking people up, putting a face on the facts of poverty and these other interlocking injustices, we're gathering there to dramatically shift the moral narrative in this country. And you say, why Maine? Well, first of all, why America? Why now? 140 million people are poor and low income in this country. That's 43% of this entire nation's population. The majority of them are white women, the disabled and children. The majority, when you look at poverty, 61% of African-American people of color are poor and low wealth. That's about 26 million people. 30-some percent of whites are poor and low wealth, but that's 66 million people. That's 40 million more just in terms of white poverty. So we have to change how poverty is even viewed. In Maine, 41% of the people here in Maine are poor and low wealth. 41%. That's 545,000 people. There's 287,000 women and 129,000 children in Maine. In Maine, I just heard one of the persons on your show, he was talking about tax cuts. Well, using trickle-down economics, from 1979 to 2012, the income for the top 1% in Maine grew by 195%, while the income for the bottom 99% only increased by 25%. There are more than 100,000 people in Maine, 200,000 people in Maine, who work every day for less than $15 an hour. And you have to work 80 hours a week at a minimum wage job, regardless of your color, just to afford a two-bedroom apartment. So we chose these states to try to dramatize how poverty is not a marginal issue. It is not just a people of color issue. It is an American issue, and it's connected to systemic racism, ecological devastation, the war economy. And lastly, we chose Maine because we looked at states where if you just had 2% of poor and low-wealth people, regardless of race, creed, color, sexuality, who would become politicized and educated and who mobilized and organized and registered people for the movement and vote, just 2% of them could fundamentally shift politics in states like the ones we're traveling to. And so we were invited to Maine, too, by the Poor People's Campaign here on the ground.
I see. So, and you mentioned the June 20th event, but that is strategically timed, that Washington March, right? Why that date is important.
Well, I think, and Liz will talk more about this, when we launched with 6 weeks of action in 43 states plus the District of Columbia, had over 5,000 people engaged in civil disobedience in all of those state capitals, taking our what we call the Poor People's Souls of Poor People's Audit. We hope all of your audience will get that book, because it lays out what's really going on in this country when it comes to poverty and systemic racism like voter suppression and health care and ecological devastation and this war economy, where we're spending 53 cents of every discretionary dollar into the war economy and less than 15 cents into infrastructure, education, and health care. But June 20th, 2020 was chosen because, first of all, the next day is the 21st, which is a summer solstice. We are going to show a light on to the nation that day. People of every race, creed, and color standing together from Maine to Mississippi, from Kentucky to the Californias, from Appalachia to Alabama. And they're going to be impacted people and moral leaders telling their stories, but then laying out a way forward and what has to change. After the primaries, we'll know who's running for president, who's running for Senate on both sides of the aisle, and before the political conventions, in order to drive into the national narrative, we cannot continue to have a political conversation that only talks about poverty, only talks about working people and the middle class, and never addresses poverty and the working poor. And we cannot have a political conversation that does not deal with the issues of systemic racism and how those who use systemic racist voter suppression, once they get elected, when they get elected, they use their power to hurt black people, white people, brown people, sick people, working people, so forth and so on.
So if the poor, and if we'll call them the poor here, as you are,
and low income,
are this potentially powerful political constituency, Reverend Theo Harris, why has it been so difficult to mobilize them over the past 50 years?
Well, I think when we actually look at where change has happened over the past 50 years, some of the gains around housing, some of the increase in Head Start programs, it's actually been because poor people have come together. But over the same 50 years, we haven't had in our national discourse, in our dialogue, our politicians, our elected leaders, our theologians and pastors and preachers and others really talking about the intersection of these issues, really lifting up the problems of poverty, the reality that 250,000 people in this country die from poverty. And that's more than who die from cancer and from strokes and from heart attacks combined. And to have an absolute silence, a media blackout, a whitewashing of the issues, the fact that we have an attack going on right now on voting rights and on democracy, the fact that you know, in this country, 15 million families are at risk of not being able to afford water when the world is made of two-thirds water. These are not the issues that have been in our dialogue. And so when people don't hear their names or their condition, it's hard for people to come together and organize. But people are. And what we're finding as we travel around this country is that poor and impacted leaders are leading the way and are winning higher wages, winning around environmental protections. Sometimes it's being reported on, sometimes it's not. But when we bring a bigger voice, when we pull the power of people together, as the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, is doing, and doing here in Maine, there is an active coordinating committee made up of impacted folks, folks that are facing a healthcare crisis, folks that are living on the streets, but who are still organizing and mobilizing and registering and educating and building a movement.
So, and Reverend Barber, I think this was your quote in the literature I read, that the People's Campaign is led by people who are sick and tired of being blamed for the conditions that make them sick and tired.
Yeah, they're not ashamed of saying we're in the poor people's movement, we're dealing with poor and low-wealth people. They're ashamed of this country when we have more wealth than any other nation in the world, and yet we have these highest rates of poverty and low wealth we haven't seen since the gap since the days of the Great Depression. You know, I keep saying 140 million people, but let me make it more personal. I'm talking about a lady I met in a homeless camp that was 200 yards down in the woods from a church that talked about homosexuals going to hell. And yet that church wasn't reaching out, and the city leaders weren't reaching out to this homeless camp of white, black, and brown people and children. She was middle class and had a health crisis, and it left her bankrupt. And she was in the woods. African-American man was in the woods who worked every day, but he worked for less than a living wage and could not afford an apartment. When we left there, I was in tears, but she grabbed me on my coat and said, "Don't let America forget us." And what we're saying is we have too much been forgotten, too much intentionality. We just have been, done to work against talking about the poor. We were just standing here in Portland with people who are homeless, and they talk about 142 people who were amputated last year because they were basically kicked out of a homeless shelter and put on the streets. Too often, we aren't hearing that. So going back to what you asked Liz, which is really important, people have gotten sick and tired. Their backs are against the wall. They know how we had a war on poverty. It's the war America left, not because we finished, but because we left the field. We had what I call a shoot down of the movement. Remember, Bobby Kennedy was killed. Martin Luther King was killed. So the movement didn't end. It was shot down. And then we've had a shut up. We've had, our political discourse. If you listen to it, any debate, what do they talk about? The middle class, the wealthy, or the working? Never really about the working poor or saying the word the poor, even though we're talking about 43% of the people and we're talking about something that impacts every race, creed, color, and class. This movement is first about building power and shifting the narrative. And now we have 43 coordinating committees in this country. We have over 120 partners, over 15 denominational and religious groups. But the real power is the agency of impacted people coming together across all of these lines that divide us and recognizing that we cannot be America if we don't address these five interlocking injustices: systemic racism, systemic poverty, ecological devastation, the war economy, and this false moral narrative of religious nationalism. If we refuse to address these issues at the peril of the very promises of America.
I'll try to break those down individually as the program moves on here. You mentioned the Great Depression. My mother lived through the Great Depression. She talked about it a lot, having been poor. And I sense that it informed her view later of poverty as a social issue because she had experienced it.
Yeah.
As we are more removed from that time, there are a lot of Americans who have never experienced poverty. Do you think that, and I'll open this to either of you, do you think that affects the overall political will of the country to address the causes of poverty?
Well, I don't think that a lot that haven't experienced. That's what we're actually saying. There are 143 million people that are experiencing it right now. But there's been a deliberate move to walk away from it. You think about, we had 26 debates in 2016, presidential debates, primaries, and the general. Not one full hour on poverty, though it impacts 43% of this nation, 140 million. That is the kind of silence that is a betrayal of everything that we say we are. We had voter suppression in ways we haven't seen since the Jim Crow, not 1 hour. And every state, for instance, that is a voter suppression state that targets black folk, the people who get elected because of that voter suppression are mostly white. And when they get elected, they are the ones that block living wages, block health care, block programs that uplift the poor, attack women's right to choose, and so forth and so on, block climate, addressing the climate reality. So we've not, and in media, many times, thank God for you doing the show today, because many times media has not addressed that. We have followed the political discourse of left versus right, conservative versus liberal, middle class versus the wealthy, and not penetrated. And that's why this movement is forcing the penetration. For instance, I was reading an article today that when seven people died of vaping, we called it a national emergency. You heard Liz say 250,000 people die every year from poverty. That is a footnoted fact. That's 600 plus people a day. And we have not had our political entities declare that as a national emergency. 37 million people without health care in a country that has the best health care. And every elected person, governors, congress people, they in essence get free health care that we pay for. We pay for that. In the Congress, they make 15 cents a minute. We have locked people up in this country who were fighting for 15 an hour of basic living wage. That's why movements, moral movements, have to engage. And remember, even during the Depression, it was the bonus marches. It was people like Francis Perkins inside of the Roosevelt administration demanding that we address labor and address living wages. It was the early social gospel movement. It was Teddy Roosevelt breaking with both parties and talking about moral issues like wages and health care and retirement. It didn't just happen. The Depression happened because of the bad policies. But out when the Depression happened, there were movements. There were moral moves, and there were immoral movements that tried to shut down the addressing of those problems. We are declaring, Liz says it incredibly, that this is a time where people who have nothing else to lose cannot just be fooled by people who give them fear and lies. We need the truth. We need moral fusion, organizing, and we must force this nation to see this problem and hear what is going on and face the faces that make up the facts.
All right, and we're going to have to take a quick break and say goodbye to you. We appreciate you joining us for this segment of the program. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. God bless.
The Reverend Dr. William Barber, President and Senior Lecturer of Repairers of the Breach. He's also an author, preacher, and professor, and Chief Architect of the Forward Together Moral Movement. He's also the co-leader of the new Poor People's Campaign. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions, the number 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Humanities Council, asking a big question for Maine. How should life be? October 19th in Portland, mainehumanities.org. And Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine energy audit and insulation rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
How much is the trade war hurting China's economy? We go inside a Chinese factory and meet a businessman moving his company's production to Vietnam.
Purely because of the tariffs. It's just got stronger and stronger and stronger. The tariffs now are just about on everything made in China.
We look at the trade war's impact on the ground in China. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Are you a regular listener to Morning Edition? When you miss it, do you wish there was some way you could still hear it, even if it's not on the radio? Well, now you can if you have an Alexa smart speaker. Just say, "Smart speaker, please play Morning Edition." Alexa will then ask you which station you want to hear, and you, of course, will say Maine Public Radio. And then Alexa will play back the last full hour of Morning Edition. So you can hear the most recent hour of Morning Edition with Erwin Gratz until 3 each afternoon. At this point in time, this is only for Alexa smart speakers, but we'll let you know if Google Home learns how to do this. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, the Poor People's Campaign, its goals, and why it's making a stop here in Maine. My guest, the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. She's director of the Cairo Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice at Union Theological Seminary. We invite you to join the conversation. The number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now is Tom Longstaff. He's a former Maine State Representative, an Episcopal priest, and a retired professor of religious studies at Colby College. And he was at the Poor People's Campaign 51 years ago. Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about your involvement with the original campaign, tell us a little bit about your personal experiences with segregation.
Right, because segregation and poverty are closely related, as the new Poor People's Campaign shows us. But back in 1953, when I graduated from high school, I grew up in Winthrop here in Maine, and I graduated from high school in 1953 and took a job as a bookkeeper. But within the next week or two, we took some really hard hits, some heavy losses in the Korean War. And like many of my high school classmates, I resigned from my job and hitchhiked into Augusta and joined the Marine Corps. I had grown up in Maine and had not really experienced firsthand segregation. When I got on the train, headed south for boot camp at Parris Island, South Carolina, I was, getting ready for my time in the Marine Corps. We went from Winthrop to Boston, changed trains, went Boston to New York, changed trains, went south. After we pulled out of Washington, headed south, I saw something I'd never seen before. The conductors came through and rounded up people who looked like me and moved us to the forward cars on the train, rounded up people of color and moved them to the back cars. I looked out the window when we stopped at rail stations and saw two drinking fountains, white and colored, two restrooms, white and colored, and sometimes three, men, women, and colored. And then I was in South Carolina for 3 years, and segregation was still legal in those days, and I saw firsthand what it meant for people who had to eat in the kitchen and the restaurants, who had to, if they went to a cafe, they'd have to take their food out to the sidewalk, so many things. And it really made an impression on me.
And so then you get to New York, you're in graduate school, and this is where you became involved in the civil rights movement?
Right. It was some years later when I got out of the Marine Corps, I came back to Maine and things here were still pretty whitened. So I went to college and seminary thinking of becoming a pastor, but decided education was my field, and to teach I would need a doctorate. So I went to New York to get a doctorate at Columbia. And that was in 1964. And the 60s were, wow, they were really something in New York and in other cities with the protests about the war in Vietnam and racial justice. And suddenly my experiences back in the 1950s came back on me just in a flood. And so I was drawn to the civil rights movement in New York, and got to know Bill Weber, George W. Weber, people in the East Harlem Protestant Parish, and really worked with them trying to do what we could do to move in the direction of social justice.
So then how did you find yourself involved in the Poor People's Campaign, the original?
Well, it was because of my work with, you know, what I was doing with the protests, with all of the things we were doing through the East Harlem Protestant Parish. And I was not a Methodist. A Congregationalist, but the UCC came to me and because of my involvement in the civil rights movement, asked if I would work for them and start a church in Westbury, New York, where they didn't have one. And so I went out there and began it to just meet with people, and we'd have little worship services in the fire station or wherever we could as we were getting started. The dream was in the 1960s that this would be an integrated parish. It didn't turn out that way. I ended up being Casper the Friendly Ghost, as I sometimes was playfully called, the pastor of essentially an all-Black congregation. We had two or three white families, and that was it. And so living in the Black community, moving back and forth between Westbury and New York City, experiencing, just seeing firsthand what people of color faced, I became involved in the movement. And when Martin Luther King was assassinated only 6 months before the Poor People's Campaign, I was one of those that signed on to go to Washington to be with the many who wanted the voices to be heard.
And so finally, what's your sense of the prospects for this new iteration of the campaign, its chances for achieving the goals it set out?
Well, I think it's not going to be an easy fight. Dealing with racism was not an easy fight. Economic, just the great margins of difference, economic inequality in this country, it's not a problem we're going to solve easily. And, minority communities know the effects of that poverty more than the rest of us. I think the chances are good because I think in many ways times are changing in this country, but we shouldn't kid ourselves and think that this is going to be something that we can accomplish quickly. I think this campaign has, with the new campaign, and Martin Luther King Jr. had this too on his agenda when we had the Poor People's Campaign in Washington, was economic justice. But look, that was 51 years ago, and it's been more than that we've been dealing with race. So I think the time is right for us to be doing this, but it is not going to be a quick or easy task.
All right. Tom, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it. Tom Longstaff is an Episcopal priest who served in the Marine Corps as a city councilor and as a state representative and professor at Colby College. Lister Harris, any comments on Tom's take, I guess, on the prospects for this campaign? He has doubts himself as a person who's worked on this whole life.
Well, I mean, I really think we need to go back and look at what Dr. King, what welfare rights leaders, what other folks were proposing, and what Tom and many others signed up for when when the launching of the 1967-1968 Poor People's Campaign happened. And, you know, we often in our society hold up Dr. King now as a great leader who had a vision and a dream for this country that has not yet been realized. But we should look at that vision even more and see that what Dr. King was proposing in this campaign was to unite and organize poor people from all geographies, from all backgrounds, to take action together. And so there's no way for us to honor him by not reaching back into that which gave him inspiration, back into the blood that he gave for work to happen, and commit ourselves to continuing that fight. And I feel very hopeful. And that hopefulness in terms of our being able to take this fight the next mile to its successful conclusion, to a society that has health care and living wages and affordable housing and decent education and has the democracy and the right to vote at its center, a society that, you know, where young people get to dream dreams and old people get to live very long lives that are beautiful. It is in our hands.
I just want to give we're not going to get to all of the demands of the mm-hmm. campaign. There are a list of demands. It's sort of rather than hopes or dreams, it's you're saying, hey, we want this to happen. Let's focus just around the poverty and inequality. There are five areas here. Talk about a couple of the demands around poverty and inequality.
So there are 62 million people working at less than $15 an hour. So a demand in this campaign is living wages, living wage jobs, the right to organize, and some kind of basic income, some guaranteed income, some strong welfare programs that could lift the load of poverty. We have 37 million people without health care coverage, as Dr. Barber was talking about earlier. And even 73% of people that even have health care insurance still can't always afford their medical bills. I mean, the number one reason for personal bankruptcy is health care.
Expanding Medicare, for example.
So expanding Medicaid and Medicare and actually a single-payer universal health care system, right? It'd be more cost effective and it would save lives. We take this issue of healthcare really seriously.
We're going to go to the phones here and we'll continue this. There's a great long list and they're all available on your website.
Poorpeoplescampaign.org. And we have a budget that shows how possible it is, how we found the money. We can do this.
That's
we're building the power.
Is how are, that's fine. That's all good. But how are we going to pay for it?
And that's right.
You have that on there. Let's go to the phones. We'll go to Frederick in Bath. Hi, Frederick. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Keith. I have to tell you initially, I am so full. My soul and my heart are so full listening to this 40 minutes. And I hope this is a bellwether for you and the staff at Public Radio in Maine to continue discussing what is really truthful about what happens in this economy and with how we view the other, whether it's someone who's poor or someone who's of a different color. I wanted to ask the dear Reverend if she would speak in terms of a, let's say, a moral capitalism versus a free market capitalism, which I feel is inherently, the free market is inherently immoral, and it is simply to mean freedom from taxation, regulation, and responsibility. And to hear conservatives like this gentleman you had on the radio, as Reverend Barber had stated, who wants to continue to pull money from our democracy, from our governments, to hand it to people who need not have more money is immoral. So let's hear how she would describe this difference between a moral capitalism and our corporate-controlled free market society.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
So as the the listener was saying, I mean, we focus on the what we define as the real moral issues of our day, looking at our Constitution, looking at sacred texts and traditions, looking at the issues that are affecting people across this country as we travel through it. And again, those real moral issues are universal health care, our living wages, our decent education, our actually the opportunity to go to college and university for free. The issues that are at the founding of this country, you know, we were provide for a common defense, promote the general welfare. I mean, in our Constitution is the word welfare. So why have we gotten away from this kind of moral grounding that says, and again, you know, we have done the numbers. We've worked with policy institutes. We've been able to show that if we raise taxes of the very small percentage of people that can really afford taxes in terms of corporations, if we cut the military budget and actually make this country, this state safer. I mean, Maine spent $16 billion over the past, I think it's like 17 years, 20 years. That money could have gone to pay for every child across the entire state having great education, Head Start programs. That money could have gone to create hundreds of thousands of people with health care. Right. So and then if we invest in the kinds of things that we should be investing in, you know, we bail out banks when we say they're too big to fail. But why can't we invest in a decent living for our people?
Okay, we need to take a quick break and we'll come back. When we do come back, I want to ask you about the campaign's belief that part of shifting the moral conversation, the moral narrative of the country has to do with resisting one that had been established by a Christian nationalist agenda. And you name names in this argument. So anyway, we'll take that up when we come back. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number again, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Martins Point Healthcare, dedicated to providing the highest quality care and coverage to the people of Maine and New Hampshire, offering Generations Advantage Medicare plans. Learn how you can enroll at generationsadvantage.com. And CEI, helping grow good jobs and a sustainable economy with business financing and advice. CEIMaine.org.
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, physician Jen Gunter and science writer Mary Roach tackle the ignorance and pseudoscience that surrounds women's reproductive health concerns. Gunter approaches the topic in a no-nonsense but humorous manner, debunking the myths, marketing, and misinformation surrounding the health of women and girls. On the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio. Season 4 of High School Quiz Show Maine wants your school to take part. This fall, there will be a qualifying test to select the top 16 schools that will compete in statewide television contests broadcast next spring. If your school is interested, we'd like to hear from you. And now on Thursday evenings at 8, you can watch a rebroadcast of Season 3 on Maine Public Television. Information about High School Quiz Show Maine is at mainepublic.org. Just click on television.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the Poor People's Campaign stops in Maine. My guest, the co-chair of the campaign, the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. We will go to the phones in a moment, but Deb writes, it's clear that you've been fortunate to never have experienced poverty firsthand. If you'd had, you'd know why poor folks haven't mobilized before, spending so much energy just surviving, stressing about money and bills constantly while parenting, working a job or three, and all the daily tasks is absolutely exhausting. I was a single parent for 12 years and will never forget the worry and fear of every day. It made me so grateful not to be in that place anymore. Your campaign obviously objects to this bootstraps mentality that in the American economy, those who work hard are rewarded and that somehow the poor are responsible for their own situations.
So So I really appreciate, you know, someone raising the hardship, the hard work that goes into being poor. I've actually been homeless myself. I've worked low-wage jobs. I've been without health care. And it was out of that experience that compelled me and is compelling tens of thousands of people across this country into taking action together. In the words of a fast food worker from Virginia, from Appalachian Virginia, our backs are against the wall and all we can do is push. This idea that it's our fault, that poor people ourselves are to blame for is just a lie, and that if we just worked hard, I mean, you know, the issue of homelessness is one that's a really important issue in this state as and you know the majority of people who are homeless are working.
Well, as we said before the break, I mentioned this. The concern about that the campaign has about what it calls a Christian nationalist agenda, and sort of goes back to the Reverend Billy Graham as one of the purveyors of this narrative that was laid out, and that you're now trying to replace with a different moral narrative. Why did you think it was important to sort of identify that source in particular? Is that divisive? Are you concerned about what that does to the religious community in the country? Or just speak to that if you want.
For many years now, we've had religious leaders who cloak themselves in a religiosity that then basically covers up a great immorality that's happening, ignores the more than 2,000 passages in the Bible that talk about welcoming the immigrant neighbor, that talk about lifting the load of poverty, that talk about that the way to honor and worship God is how you treat the poor. The passages from Isaiah 10, woe to you who pass unjust laws, to talk about the structural problems of poverty and those who have been made poor by injustice. And so to have so many faith leaders right now, you know, covering up immoral, unjust, anti-biblical policies in the name of Christian nationalism, in the name of Christianity. And as Dr. Barber, who was on the program earlier, says, these faith leaders will pray, P-R-A-Y, over national leaders who are praying, P-R-E-Y-ing, over the poor. And that's totally counter to our faith traditions.
Let's go to Grayson in Portland. Hi, Grayson. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I do want to say it brought me a great sense of joy and hope to hear that there's a pushback against, you know, the right-wing Christian co-option of, you know, religion, and I'm not a religious person, but that gives me a great sense of joy. Secondly, the Reverend Barber was speaking about 2016 and candidates not speaking about poverty, not speaking about living wages, not speaking about universal health care and so many other things we're talking about. I just want to say that Bernie Sanders was speaking about all these things. He really, I think, opened the door to talk about poverty, to talk about a rigged economic system. There are a number of candidates now in 2020 who are using these issues and getting a great deal of traction. I see a lot of hope in that. So I'm hopeful that this movement is going to keep moving forward. So I just wanted to say that I think candidates are speaking about this. Maybe the guests could speak about the 2020 race. And I plan on being there in June in D.C. So thanks, and I'll take my call offline.
All right, Grayson, thank you. So yes, the point, one of the points of the campaign is to put these issues front and center in the 2020 election.
Indeed, I mean we cannot go through another election cycle where the problems of homelessness, of poverty, of cuts of social programs, of the lack of health care aren't front and center. And I think the reason we actually hear and need to celebrate the fact, but then keep on pushing candidates are taking up these issues is because people are organizing, because people are coming together and saying, this is what interests us. And what we've found is that, you know, there's 140 million poor and low income people that live in this country. I mean, that's 2 million more than the 138 million people total that voted in the last election. And so there is a power of poor people coming together, making our politicians take up the issues that are defining our lives, the solutions that people who are impacted are coming up with, and building a power that makes our power structures say yes when they may actually not want to do anything. And so, you know, I think it's victory. And now the question is what policies are we going to be able to put forward? What wins are we going to be able to win as a movement to lift this load and to address these issues?
Will the campaign endorse a presidential candidate at some point?
We are a deeply political movement, but we are completely nonpartisan. And so we, you know, and we actually thinking about these issues as Democrat versus Republican, left versus right, that's too small. That's too puny of a framework. I mean, we have people from all political parties, all political persuasions that are a part of this Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. What we're saying is that if we raise the issues, if we tell the stories of the untold stories of the 140 million people, the folks that are living with raw sewage in their yards, this 1/15th of every person who is living in a homeless encampment, the folks that are having to bury their children because of the lack of Medicaid expansion, or because even if they had health care insurance, they still couldn't afford life-saving medicines, that those are the issues and that we're going to put front and center. And you know, we welcome candidates to again, not just have lip service, but to come behind those. But no, we will not endorse.
Let's go to Duncan in Belfast. Hi, Duncan. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to say that I feel the same joy and goodness that other callers have had, that you guys are running this show on the air. I think the media silence about all this is something that you have the courage to address. And this is mainstream America that you're talking about. So if you get pushed back about having such a radical thing as these people, I want to encourage you to stay with what you're doing. I'm a 1971 graduate of Union Theological Seminary. I studied New Testament there, and I love hearing this voice once again. So thanks.
All right, Duncan, thank you. I do want to talk, before we run out of time, about the demands around the environment, the concern about climate change, which has become so politicized. Why do you think that has happened? I mean, we're talking about scientific descriptions and predictions about changing climate, and yet it has become incredibly polarized. What's your view on why that has happened?
I mean, to us, we have to take up this question of ecological devastation and of the climate crisis, because it's, you know, impacting just in truth and fact the majority of people, and especially impacting poor and marginalized folks. And so when you look at the environmental movement, what you see is that the oil and gas industry is able to invest billions and billions of dollars into distracting us from talking about you know, the reality of what corporations are doing to people's lives. And so it means that a movement of people who are impacted, who might not have that lobbying power, might not have those dollars, but who can draw the connection. And to us, it's so important that people see that we have to address these interlocking injustices together, that we can't be interested in just undoing racism, and that we won't be able to undo racism without taking up the questions of the environment, that we have to talk about this war economy. I mean, and if we're going to talk about the issue of the ecology and the environment, the kind of pollution that is happening because of us having an economy that has constant war and warmongering. And so you know, we connect racism, poverty, the environment, and the war economy all together, and say that you know, that those who are most impacted by those crises have a power to change them. And we want everybody that can make it to Portland this evening. We're going to be having a rally and a mass meeting, and we need people to come and make your voices heard on June 20th, 2020 in Washington, D.C., when we have a mass Poor People's Assembly and Moral March on Washington.
We've got about a minute left, but if you give us a little more detail about tonight's event.
So this evening we will be gathering. We have been invited by the Maine Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival here in Portland. There'll be a march. Folks will be there showing all of the different issues and all the different organizations that have come together to be this campaign in the state. And we'll have a mass meeting where you'll get to hear from those that are being impacted across Maine by these issues, who are putting forward their stories, but then also the solutions, the demands that are coming out of Maine and other states across this country. And you'll also have a chance to hear from other moral religious leaders, Reverend Barber, myself, about why we all must do more. We need to mobilize, organize, register, and educate. And that's at First Parish Unitarian Universalist in Portland.
And at what time is it?
People are gathering to march at 5:45 at the park nearby. The mass meeting itself will be after that.
All right. Reverend Theo Harris, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. She's director of the Cairo Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice at Union Theological Seminary. Thanks also to the Reverend Dr. William Barber. He is president and senior lecturer of Repairers of the Breach. He's an author, preacher, professor, and co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, who joined us earlier. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful hints and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.